history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories there that really need to be told, and we'll never hear them unless we take a little time to ask a few questions and listen to what comes back our way. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. We're coming up on the 78th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor, and we have the privilege of meeting a Pearl Harbor survivor today in Porterville, California, home for the last 73 years to Chuck Keene, 97 years old, 97 and a half, I guess I should say. But you didn't grow up in California. You're from Burley, Idaho. Where is that, and how big is it?
Well, it's about 5,000 people, and it's about 200 miles north of Salt Lake City on the Snake River in southern Idaho.
So what was that childhood like in Burley, Idaho?
There's nine members of the family, and my dad was an optometrist. We planted gardens and took care of rent house. We had several rental houses, and we spent all of our time taking care of work. And a lot that I learned at home was I used in later life, like plumbing and electrical work and start of it, I learned before I ever went into service.
Well, and I'm always curious, too, because the war changed so many lives. I mean, it changed all of our lives if we're looking closely enough at it. But were there some ideas or ambitions you had before you decided to join the Navy that you thought, hey, someday I'm going to do X, Y, Z?
Yes, I wanted to be an electrical engineer or a guy in forestry is what my dad wanted me to be. He offered me money for that, but my brothers just could not believe that he was going to give me money and wouldn't give them money to go to college. It was such a mess that I told him, no, I'm going to go in the Navy. And I turned him down. But I wanted to go into the Forest Service building in some capacity.
And so I'm clear when you say you decided to go in the Navy instead. Was that because you knew the Navy would help you pay for college if you went in the service?
No, not really. I went into the service because the war was just starting over in France. The war had started, and the guys were flying planes and everything like that. And I just, like a Miller to the fire, I wanted to go see what was happening. I wanted to be part of it, and the Navy was the quickest way to get there.
And since you mentioned how big your family was, I'm curious how many of your siblings also ended up serving in World War II.
Just two, both in the Army and not for a very long time. One, then my youngest brother, went into the Air Force after I got out. See, I was in the war for 6 years, and all of my family was growing. The kids, all the younger, had 6 years of growth, and I never even knew them, really. When I come home, they were strangers to me.
So you joined the Navy in February 1941. Did you expect America to be at war soon?
Yes. Yeah, I thought we already were at war, just didn't know it.
What were those first few months in the Navy like for you? What did they do with you?
Like a little kid with a new toy, really. Number one, I could smoke if I wanted to smoke. My mother wouldn't get after me for cussing. And little things like that, but very short order. You see, I went in February, and in December we were at war. From June on, we were preparing for war real fast, getting the ship stripped down and, you know, all of the bric-a-brac on the ship off, you know, the ceremonial stuff, getting rid of that so we could go to sea. We shipped out in September of 41, and we just barely got in there and got aboard ship. The Honolulu. I went out on a destroyer and went aboard the Honolulu in Pearl Harbor.
And what was Pearl Harbor, or just Oahu in general, what was the life like there in the weeks or months leading up to December 7th?
It was a good life because I'm not like the normal guy. I liked the libraries and I liked to go visit. I really did. I got a big kick out of reading and going around and looking at how the pineapple grew, and it was just like a new experience, like I was in a new land, and it was different from anything that I'd seen in Idaho.
And what were your duties aboard the Honolulu?
Supposed to be an electrician. I passed Class A school, and and to do the wiring and put the fuses and stuff in blocks. We had, when it first started, you just had simple things to do, but eventually when the war started, all of the little treats and things that were on there were all gone. Everything was necessary, and you had better take care of it the best you could. I used my training from Class A Electrical School, and it helped me a lot on there because I was quite a bit ahead of some of the other kids that come in because they knew nothing about it.
And so you would have been 19 years old when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. I want to hear about the morning of December 7th, but I'm curious, do you remember anything about the night before, Saturday night, December 6th?
Yeah, I was down and getting ready to do my first night of mess cooking aboard ship. At that time, everybody had to do 6 weeks of mess cooking, and that was the old chief cook was showing us all the things that we had to do, how to fix the trays. I was going to put the trays and wash, after the guys had eaten, I washed the trays and put them in a rack. That was going to be my job when I got up the next morning, and that's what I got up to, is we no more started breakfast and the general quarters alarm rang. I ran topside, and here was a Japanese Zero coming right down the dock, just strafing the hell out of things, you know. My buddy, Freeberg, from Seattle, we were topside searchlights, big searchlights. We had to man those searchlights. Well, it seemed sort of dumb to do anything with a searchlight in broad daylight, so we were down helping wherever we could, and I was helping try to get ammunition to these 3-inch guns, because they had no provisions for that. They had a locker full of them, and so we'd throw the locker open and try to keep shells enough for the guns, and then the gun got hot and it jammed, and we just had all kinds of problems. Then you'd go to the next one. We just sort of all over the ship the first day until we were hit. They come by, they dropped a bomb, and it hit the dock and exploded underneath the ship and caved our whole front of the ship in, the 500-pound bomb, and so we couldn't go anywhere because our magazine had collapsed, and they were afraid it was going to blow up. And so the next 3 days, I spent myself down in my shorts and skivvies, you would say, and with stockings, and going down there sweeping up gunpowder with a foxtail and by the pail to get it out of there to where it's a miracle we didn't blow up right then, you know, but the only thing that they said that saved us was it collapsed the peak tanks where the water was. It forced the water right back into the magazine, and so it didn't explode. That's why I'm still here, is because if that had gone off, we'd all been gone. But
well, and I know there are a couple other moments throughout the war where you might not have been here if it didn't go a certain way. But I'm wondering, while you're doing all this and this is happening, while you realize your ship is under attack, did you ever have a chance to look out and see what else was happening throughout Pearl Harbor?
They flew right by our fantail, the torpedo bombers that were torpedoing the battleships come right by. They swooped down into the water just in back of our ship and launched their torpedoes for the battleships. We had what they call a blister. Those torpedoes didn't do much damage to the ship because they put it right in 39 or somewhere along there. They put what they call 6-inch blisters on the battleship, so they decided to make it so the torpedoes wouldn't hit them. They pretty well sheltered it off, but the ones that got all of it was the armor pierced, and they flew and they dropped the bombs down, and they come down through the deck that way and exploded. But the big explosion we heard was the Shaw and two ships in dry dock. They exploded, and that just like crushed me. It killed one guy on the dock, because you see the docks have a revetment alongside there that you can put stuff back in, that's cinder block or whatever it is like that, and all of your weapons and everything were stored back in that area. Well, this guy was standing in there, so when the blast that hit me went on through, it hit him, but it came off the back of that thing and he just crushed him. And that's the first time that I saw a guy just dead by explosion. I mean, it just killed him.
Well, and you said something about yourself feeling that too. So what did you feel? What did you experience?
My experience was just like somebody grabbed me and just crushed my lungs. And I couldn't, for a minute, I didn't think I was ever going to really breathe again. It marked me so that even after the war, sudden sounds for a long time. They never had any therapy or any way to treat us for it, but if a sudden sound would shake and and I'd be shaking inside. You know, I could hold my hands here, but it seemed like everything inside was jerking. It takes several hours for that to go away. When I had that for years, you know, every sudden noises or something shake. But that big damage that I had was that explosion aboard that dry dock.
Well, that's one of the most captivating photos from Pearl Harbor, is the Shaw. Yeah, the concussion of that explosion smacked you in the chest.
It smashed me, yeah. It knocked me down. I couldn't stand. I mean, I went down. I didn't know what had happened to me. And then I got up. You can't imagine getting hit. Well, if you played football or something, you might, but it's not really as hard because it crushes you from both sides. You just feel like everything is coming out your mouth.
So, again, this is a 19-year-old kid from Idaho who's been living in paradise, and now his world is turned upside down. And I was struck by something you wrote down for your family, a few memories, when you said, "We were attacked on December 7th, 1941 by the Japanese." You wrote, "Our fleet was destroyed, and so was my innocence." What did you mean by that?
Well, I'd never seen death before. I'd never seen that my kind of suffering. I never did, and never have since. The worst day of the war was the worst day of my life. It was awful. It all seemed like it all run together to the 11th, to December 11th. It seemed like there was no night or day. We were just trying to clean up, you know. We still had guys trapped underwater. We had guys trying to get out. We had a lot of 2,000 guys burned, laying on the dock, trying to take care of them. It was just a big mess for till the 11th. Then we finally, they said, well, on the 11th, they came and said, well, we're going to go back to San Francisco, because we didn't know how much damage it had on the ship, but it was extensive, and we had to go get it fixed. So that put us back in perspective, and it calmed down a little bit. We had some of our ships, planes trying to fly in from one of the other airports to fly in there, and our guys were so gun-shy, they were shooting at our own planes.
And you mentioned sweeping up the gunpowder to try to avoid a secondary explosion.
Yeah.
What else were you doing for those next few days after the attack?
Mostly repairing the bulkhead so the ship could get out. And believe it or not, we had to use timber. We had timber on there. I never dreamed that they'd have it on there, but we had 4x4s, 4x6, until we could block that side of the ship. So if we got underway, that it wouldn't cave in any more than where it was. So I was being carpenter for part of the time, and tying things up. We tied everything up that we could, and just got rid of all the junk on there. Anything that we didn't need to go to war, you got rid of. You'd be surprised how much crap you'd get aboard a ship, you know, that you don't need.
And, you know, we know with the lens of history, we know that the Japanese came in two waves that day to Oahu, and they were also hitting other places like the Philippines and Clark Field. But you guys didn't know if they were coming back to Oahu again after December 7th. Was there a concern that more was coming in the days that followed?
They were sure that there's going to be carriers in there, and they never realized that he'd turned these carriers around and gone back to Japan. But according to the amount of fuel and weaponry and everything that we had on ours, we could figure they could have come right on in. So we were under alert entirely. For the next, I guess they stayed on alert even after we got out of there, and they wanted everything that could move and get out, because they figured another more attack.
It's time for our first break, but there's much more to explore with 97-year-old Chuck Keene of Porterville, California. More from the aftermath of the attack on Pearl Harbor, not to mention his close calls aboard the cruiser USS Honolulu, as well as the destroyer escort John C. Butler. Check out the photos and video at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.